This is a story about a boy who became very lost. It's a story about the girl who helped him find his way. Then she left him on his own. Then she died. It's a story about spending 20 years of your life trying to forget 1 year of your life. It's a story about ghosts. It's a story about being trapped in time. It's a story about what it means to be haunted.
That's Eric Newsom. He's a writer and a public radio colleague, well, a public radio boss, actually. He's NPR's vice president for programming. And that's how he begins his new memoir called Giving Up the Ghost. And in this story, which is true, Eric admits that for years he was scared of ghosts. Not just a little creeped out by them, but really terrified.
Yeah, I tried to keep it hidden, and many of my friends thought it was a joke. If you say you're scared of heights, people don't start talking about tall buildings. If you say you're an alcoholic, people don't tell you how much they love booze. But when you say you're scared of ghosts, people want to tell you ghost stories.
It's a little unkind.
Yeah, and it's horrifying. But for me, I just went out of my way to avoid anything involving ghosts. A trailer for a scary movie, Halloween stuff. I would just go out of my way just to avoid it. Or if even just walking down the street, someone commented, oh, that house is haunted. People hear noises in it all the time. I would go across the street. I didn't want to walk on the sidewalk in front of the place.
Of course, in some ways, we're all haunted, right? By memories, regrets, people we've lost. But your story revolves around two specific ghosts, one real girl and one ghost that you saw or thought maybe you saw from the time you were a kid. The one you called the little girl in blue?
Yeah, little girl in a blue dress. She never had a name to me. I just always thought of her as being that. We moved into a house in Canton, Ohio. It was a nice house, you know, 3-bedroom, 4-bedroom house, you know, colonial, kind of typical. But it was old, and it made a lot of creaky noises, as old houses do.
And you were how old?
I was 10 or 11 when we moved into that house. And almost immediately, we could start hearing noises upstairs, like a thudding sound. And we thought it was the cat jumping around on the furniture upstairs. And then we realized that we were hearing these thudding sounds, and the cat was right there with us. So it, well, obviously, it wasn't her. So we never could figure out what it was. And as I entered my preteens, I started to have a regular recurring dream of seeing this little girl in a blue dress at the end of a pathway. And as I approach her, she starts to try to speak to me, but it's either in some foreign language or gibberish or something. It just makes no sense to me. And as we get closer and closer, she seems more frantic to want to tell me something. And then I'd wake up. But I always had this feeling when I woke up that she was there.
And this was scary?
It was horrifying. There was something she was trying to warn me about, or she was trying to harm me, or there was something bad associated with this. You know, at the same time, you know, I'm kind of like this dorky outcast kid having increasing trouble with social connections with people, increasingly depressed, and all this kind of cycled in on itself. And that's where the other girl comes into the story, which is my friend Laura, who, as I was kind of cutting myself off or losing my connection with almost everyone else in the world, she was the one constant. Many nights of the week, the two of us would just, you know, it's Canton, Ohio, we're teenagers, we have no money, we have nowhere to go, we have nothing to do. So we would just drive out on country roads, find some abandoned place where no one would find us, and just hang out.
The two of you became really close friends. And at the same time, your life continued to kind of unravel. Mm-hmm. You know, you still had this feeling of being stalked by this strange ghost, and you were getting more and more depressed. At some point, you began thinking about suicide.
Yeah, I had the unfortunate, you know, I was supposed to be a college student at the time. And one of the books we read was David Hume's Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, which contained a couple posthumous essays as well. And one of them was about suicide. There was something, I'm going to mangle this quote, but it was something along the lines of, no one ever gave up a life that was worth keeping. He then goes on to say, basically, if you feel your life is not worth living, then that should be your biggest indicator that Providence has elected for you not to live it. All you're doing by not killing yourself is delaying the inevitable.
Kind of a toxic message to fall on the ears of a depressed teenager.
It is. And and to me, it became a justification for the way I felt. And what I felt was the answer to all of it was just to check out. So I acquired a little glass, a vial, a little clear plastic thing. And I bought a bunch of sleeping pills. And I carried them with me for months. Whenever I got into situations with people where I felt anxious or I didn't know what to do or people were upset with me, you know, I could reach in my coat pocket and I could feel that there and know that I had an automatic out whenever I needed it.
So it felt a little like a safety blanket in a way.
It felt like a choice. I always had a reason not to do it, but I always knew it was there.
Do you think you really would have?
If left unchecked, I would have, yeah. No one's ever asked me that directly, and I've never really answered it out loud to myself, but that's the truth. Yeah, I would have.
What saved you?
An accident, literally and figuratively. I was up one morning very upset, and I got in my car, and I drove down the driveway, and I just remember like having this moment of just thinking, you know, F it, you know, I'm done. And I just hit the accelerator. The car hit the side of the house and the back steps, and it did almost no damage to the house. It tore the front wheel off the car. According to what I'm told, and I have no memory of this at all, I called my mother at work and said I had an accident and that I was upset and, you know, wanted to die and all these other things. And she took me to the hospital. They asked me a series of questions, which I obviously answered incorrectly. And I was put in observation for 14 days, which ended up being a little longer than that.
From the way you tell the story in the book, it sounds like it was kind of your friend Laura who pushed you back into real life.
She gave me a reason to live because she never stopped caring about me. And it's not to say that nobody else cared about me, but I think everyone in my life was so frustrated and because they just didn't know what to do. I had kind of woven this web of deceit, so no one really even knew how bad off I really was. She kind of was the one who kind of never blinked, kind of stuck with me, even drove me home from the hospital.
So you've pulled your life together, but Laura herself has also become a ghost because mm-hmm. you made it out of those teenage years, but she didn't.
Right, yeah.
What happened to her?
She left. She moved to New York for school, which I, at that time, considered a betrayal. I took it very poorly. We had tried on occasion to get together. We talked on the phone a little bit. She really didn't tell me much about her life. I knew she worked at a bookstore in New York. I knew she went to college. Then I ran into a friend one night outside of a bar. And we said, oh, let's talk. And she told me that Laura had been hit by a car and killed about a month before. What I learned when I wrote this book is actually those years, about 2 years between when she left and when she died, where she kind of went through her own version of what I did. She disappeared a couple times. When she finally left New York, she surfaced after a couple weeks in New Orleans, refused to tell anybody why, how she'd even gotten there or what she was doing there, and would come home on the condition that no one ever asked her. And no one ever knew.
At the beginning, you said, really, your story is about what it's like to be haunted. And mm-hmm. I was thinking, that's it, really, the feeling of being left with something that's unresolved with just a question, which is also the condition of life, isn't it?
It's interesting. We use ghosts as a cautionary tale for our own lives and to understand and give ourselves hope, in a sense, that there's something afterwards. I spent a lot of time with spiritualists when I was writing this book, people who believe basically that mediumship is a vehicle to understand God and to connect to the dead, to the living, to have them be spiritual guides to the living. It's actually kind of a little bit of a kooky religion and very odd when you encounter it, and quite humorously odd. But the underlying tone of it is grief. The people who go to spiritualism don't go there because they've had happy lives full of positive experiences. They go there because they've suffered loss or they've suffered death, and they want some sort of connection to understand that life as we know it or ourselves go beyond that. You know, the hardest thing for me to think about when I think of Laura is that she died in 1988, and to think of all that I've experienced since then, and that's all completely unknown and foreign to her. It just doesn't seem fair that a life would end. And just the idea that she might have some consciousness beyond that, be it as a ghost or otherwise, is somehow, as much as it's frightening to me, also kind of comforting to me.
Do you ever feel like it's partly your job to live well, to finish out the life that she didn't get to have?
Yes. For many years, I was kind of saddled with the belief that the wrong person had died out of that period, that she should have lived. And I don't allow myself to think of what would she have thought of this? Would she like this band? How would she react to this happening? Because it seems such a false and bottomless pit of an idea. But the one thing I do walk away with is a sense of obligation that someone made an investment in me of her time, and that I owe it to her to make the best use of it.
Eric Newsom is vice president for programming at NPR and author of a memoir called Giving Up the Ghost.